and on the stairs, you know they just don't care. I can't take the smell, can't take the noise. Got no money to move out, I guess I got no choice. Rats in the front room, roaches in the back, junkies in the alley with the baseball bat. I tried to get away, but I couldn't get far, cause I'm
hello everybody, and welcome to another edition of Funkonomics, broadcasting live from WPRK, Winter Park, Florida, the voice of Rollins College, and the best in basement radio. And
what?
Dr. Benjamin Ballack.
Lazy Saturday.
Jose Galvez. Hello. That's how you pronounce it? Galvez?
Galvez.
Got it. I'll remember it for the next time. I'm Jesse Velez. I guess we're going to do just 1 hour today.
Yeah, right. We're not entirely sure because there's supposed to be a basketball game.
Right.
It's not local. So it's played at, the team we're playing against. I think it's uh-huh. Men's basketball. So I don't know. So we'll see if somebody shuts us up at two.
I'm a terrible alumni. Because I don't even know who's playing or
me neither.
The score or who are they.
Yeah,
I plead absolutely no interest in any sport of any kind.
Something about investing money and watching people chase each other after a ball, and
hey,
then whatever else happens afterwards, right?
Yeah.
It's diverse, you know. Just we were just joking about it before. How even stuff that I do like to do, at least in part of my life, I never really like to watch sports. That part of my brain, I guess. Was damaged at some point, you know?
At the same time, you gotta, show some, I find some, really high appreciation for some students mm-hmm. who can pull off being in athletics, taking that highly seriously, and still do really awesome in their courses.
And it does take coordination, so, I'm somebody who pretty much stumbles over just about everything.
Yeah, that's difficult to do, man. You see, hard workers and stuff like that, you know what I mean? It's, good stuff.
And it's not easy, too, because many of the, at least in the college leagues, they literally, they couldn't have thought of a worse way to structure it. I mean, the biggest games are at the worst time for any student.
Right
at the end of the semester, while during finals. And
yeah.
I'm kind of happy to be able to some of my crazy pedagogy, all the gamification mm-hmm. and stuff like that I do in my classes is a lot about flexibility for students. They have to be self-motivated and responsible, but they have a lot of flexibility in what and when and how to do the work.
Yeah.
So I get a lot of athletes actually in these classes because really that saves their, they can take that week off. They have mm-hmm. games and they can catch up after with for no penalty. So so it's really helpful. Them and working people sometimes too.
Yeah, back in Colorado, I had a good friend who was basically traveling for a largest proportion of the semester, not even in athletics, but in the band, right? Mm-hmm. He played snare drum in the band, and they travel as much, but without athletics aspect, right? But I mean, when you talk to some of the students in athletics, it's kind of we woke up today at 6 a.m. and already swam 4 miles today. And it's
sacrilege.
How would I actually be able to? How would I be able to? Yeah.
It's like something out of Children Out of the Corn or something,
Yeah.
That early in the morning,
That early, swim 4 miles. Oh, no, thank you. Yeah, I pass.
Right. Yeah, only the chickens that get up that early in my household.
No, I get up very early because I follow the insane schooling system forcing teenagers to wake up. And,
who decided school systems ours, I wonder? Because if you think about it, the entry time is really silly. The exit time is also really silly.
Well, there's a couple. I asked about
that. Do you know
where
does that come from?
Well, the bus schedule is one of the things that they have a lot of cuts, so they have to, manage with limited resources.
Mm-hmm.
I have to say that despite on the one hand, most of the school reform era movement is a racket. Our public schooling system isn't working really.
Hey, Jay Gordon just walked in.
Right.
Jay's in the house.
We've got problems with the school, but also the kids need to be able to work after school.
You know, strangely enough,
I've
read
for money.
I've read a few journals on that topic about sleep, whether it's beneficial for kids to get up that early in the morning and learn something. And there's various reports, at least that I've read, on the psych side that it's not good.
I think so. I mean, and to some extent, it's also well established.
It's long-term effects of chronic lack of sleep in teenagers. Because again, when I had to deal with my kids, that's how I learned with it. I was tearing my hair out. What the hell is this, right? Mm-hmm. So look it up, right? Do your homework. So yeah, what Jesse's saying, absolutely correct. Depression and violence. So next time we have a school shooting, maybe part of it is also that, you know, we force kids at a formative age to live under a structure that messes with their brain. I mean, essentially we're like doing, you know, it's kind of a form of torture.
I mean, I think that in the 60s and 70s, like some feminist econ people were actually talking about how it also messes up the ability to work a full day for moms, right? It has an impact also on the family, right? Sure. Because now, You have to get part-time because you got to be picking up your kids at 3 if you pick them up, right? So why don't you just keep them there for a bit later and get them there a bit?
True, but let me be mean. That's their choice.
That's true.
That's their choice. I'm sorry.
Whose choice?
Parents. They want to have kids.
Oh, we're breeders, man. You know, we deserve absolutely no compassion. You know, we're irresponsible, selfish breeders. I'm the only breeder in the room, I believe. You're a semi breeder.
What does that mean? A semi breeder?
He's a formal breeder. If you guys think I'm mean, tune into the Organic Catnip Show when I'll play A Junkie's Christmas by William Sabaro.
Oh God, yeah, that's great. Yeah,
that's going on the Organic Catnip Show after midnight, Christmas.
I've been so busy, I even haven't like spread any of my habitual Christmas hate yet, you know, on the networks and everything. But I will.
Yeah. It's important actually.
Yeah, you must spread the Christmas hate.
Yeah. And talking about hate, what's your guys' opinion about what happened in California? If you've been paying attention, you know.
Vaguely.
Just another day in the U.S., right? Pretty much.
Starting to feel that way, tragically.
You know, what happened over there has just basically been labeled, but when you compare it to all the stuff that happens in the inner cities, you know, on a daily basis, it's pretty much the same thing.
Yeah.
Well, I think that particular county was relatively problematic in the same ways, like the same type of problems you have in inner cities from what I was reading about that particular location, also like highly influenced by poverty, right? Crime rates there around the place are high. So I don't know if there is actually a difference between speaking about that spot
I'm familiar with the area. I mean, most people, I'm familiar with the area. But most people, from up there drive, down to LA, and I can imagine being every single day in that traffic in the parking lot, you know, and then have to deal with all the, issues of the day, you know, people's prejudice and, you know, just economics, way of life.
No, but people
can just snap.
I like your point. Again, I'm coming to this from a point of view of actually not knowing a lot about it, but right? I mean, so we have two people, right? I mean, that were well prepared and armed, kind of full militia mode, probably for some time. And they shot up a bunch of random people, right?
Right.
Really random, right? Where were they? Some office,
apparently,
checking my semi-facts.
Apparently the one guy, he worked at some, county, department. And they were having some sort of a Christmas party, and he got into an argument with somebody. He left, and then he came back, and that's when they started shooting. You know, a lot of
sounds
him
like
and his
somebody
wife.
Going postal. You know, employing their place of job. No, but of course, where does it get funny, right? Wait a minute. We keep it right. There's that big elephant in the room. We're not mentioning if I'm following correctly, if I'm wrong, right?
Right.
Oh, they are brown skinned. And they are Muslims.
Right, exactly. Yeah.
They behave your standard, you know, white bread American mass shooter.
Right.
Shooting somebody for some, you know, random grievance, highly armed, probably kind of into the power trip, which is, you know, surely what having a lot of guns and
right. That's the image that's pretty much been portrayed out there by movies, media and all this other stuff.
But it was declared terrorism, wasn't it?
Yes.
So purely on ethnic grounds.
I think they wanted to push it as a terrorism thing. Just to sway some other people, you know, in the world.
I don't really know what the evidence out there is linking them to any terrorist. But from what I've read, apparently there is some. I don't know to what extent is the case closed. What I found interesting is that one of the shooters was a female. That's something you don't hear about. It was a couple, right?
And apparently she was the one that actually had gone and either trained or made contact with ISIS. Mm-hmm. But I mean, this sounds more kind of like
I think they even traveled
around the Middle East a month before, or a couple months before, or something like that. But again, you know, like I personally think it sounds more kind of like
watching the TV late night, and all of a sudden, you know, some preacher got on, and all of a sudden they went like, "Oh my God!" You know, I've seen the light and just freaked out. Mm-hmm. I don't think it's the kind of terrorism that the U.S. Department, you know, wants to put on it. Mm-hmm. I think that the fact that they are Muslim, they actually went. But you know, the same thing could be said about the Joker, the guy from Denver, that painted himself. I mean, obviously. I don't know if ISIS would actually paint themselves like that.
Kid that shot, sorority girls because they wouldn't sleep with him. And again, not specific ones, but just random, right? Went out to shoot pretty sorority girls because some sorority girls broke his heart.
And what's the difference
then
between that?
Then he's a troubled youth. Right. Then he's a troubled youth, you know, certainly, you know, some psycho, right? Mental disorder. But the minute a very similar event happens to somebody who is ethnically associated,
and there was no religious chanting or anything like that, you know, and ISIS would have jumped on and gone like, "Yeah, we planned this right away." I mean, most terrorists and take credit for it like right away,
like with the Paris attacks, actually, right? Like they did kind of,
not even in a couple hours, they went like,
I remember initially there was the innuendos about the fact that at least one of them was a recent, refugee from Syria.
Right.
Used in order to argue for, you know, closing of the doors, to refugees. And that was completely just, you know, a rumor that popped. It was a lot of people wanted to believe it. It was a very convenient truth, as it were, but it ended up being completely fake. Those are all local kids. So let's push it further a little bit. What if those were a pair of people that had feelings towards their Middle Eastern ethnic or whatever? I don't know. I'm right. I don't know exactly who they were, how religious, but they were acting out of anger and frustration against the United States. What if that really was their motivation? As opposed to somebody who acts based on their anger and frustration against womankind. Both are scary.
I think
we shouldn't even say abortion clinics, by the way, right? Because it's where we are kind of rhetorically reinforcing. I'm not shy of my utter support of women having absolute control over their body in any way they see fit, so long as it's in them. So I'm not apologetic about being pro-choice and beyond. Mm-hmm. But we know that, you know, some 97% of all they do in these family planning centers, Planned Parenthood, has got nothing to do with abortion. It's got to do with giving
women's health.
Decent women's health. Majority of women who cannot afford these.
And that's the most sad part, right? Like by making them dangerous, you're making the clinics not for like the people who might not need women's health, but you're making it like pretty bad for the most needy, really. Because those are the type of women. That in order to stay healthy, they need a clinic like this. And it's that's no secret to anybody, no?
Right, I mean, and to me,
that is the, if you'll allow me to be flippant and inappropriate and everything, but that to me is Christian Taliban.
Yeah, right.
Again, to draw these parallels, that we all have these nutters and we all have to deal with them, and I don't think we can kill them there or here. Right? I think we have more. We need to figure out more sophisticated solutions to the rising nuttery around the world.
And perhaps it's a good idea to just start talking in terms of like fundamentalism as a problem. Mm-hmm. Doesn't matter what type,
right.
You know. Doesn't matter if it's Christian fundamentalism or Muslim fundamentalism or Scientologist fundamentalism, mm-hmm. Right?
Or Sam Harris fundamentalism.
Yeah. Or market fundamentalism. Or atheistic fundamentalism. Yeah. Because we even have that.
Yeah, know, and
which is kind of funny, but true.
Yeah.
So right, a true faith essentially. Note that big religions with a track record, you know, Catholicism, Judaism, Islam, and others. And I'm not belittling even the craziest ones. You know, Mormons are always welcome in my house. I always kind of give them a smile and tell them that, you know, I respect them just as much as I respect anybody else who comes to my door asking for stuff.
You know, but they never answer about Joe Smith.
I mean, I'm always cool about with them. About though. I feel you know,
Cat Factory.
They have their story. That's fair enough. Who am I to tell them that their story is a little bit foolish? I mean, look, you know, Catholics had you know, millennia to refine their story. So it's probably, you know, Jews had a lot of weird influences.
Produced movies about it.
Exactly. You know, so give Scientology a few centuries. Maybe they'll get their story a little bit better.
The Catholics need Spielberg to rewrite the whole story.
Ayn Rand has become a kind of a religious figure in our society. So I think, you know, Randianism and Scientology actually, to me, are extremely barely distinguishable, quite frankly.
But I mean, in defense of nerds,
I like Scientology a little better because, you know, there's like aliens and
stuff blowing up, you know?
Rand is such a horrible sci-fi writer, you know. I'm not talking about politics. My problem with her as a massive sci-fi fan is just no, lady, this is an awful novel, you know.
Yeah. But take your science fiction for what it is, man. Be honest with science fiction. Yeah. You know, I find that like if you look at some fundamentalist story behind their fundamentalism, it's just as good as bad science fiction, as Ben is pointing out, sure. Right?
You know what I think of what happened with Scientology was that Ron Harvard wanted to play a joke on somebody, and all of a sudden came up with that, and he just kept on going. He couldn't stop.
Dude, you'd be amazed. You know, like nobody knows, you know? In the field of economics except for a few people. Luckily, I studied under somebody who was like the biggest expert on the guy who turn of the previous century, from the 19th to the 20th, Vilfredo Pareto. And one of the inventors of modern economics. And today, most criteria for whether a policy or any kind of economic activity is a good thing or not is some version of a thing called Pareto optimality. So it's been rendered in many versions and nuances and augmented and graphic. Potential and what have you. But the original notion of Pareto optimality is kind of commonsensical. So there's nothing wrong with it. It's the idea that if you can do something that'll help somebody without hurting anybody else, go ahead and do it.
Which is problematic, right? Because I think it's also worth pointing out that there is other ways of looking at efficiency, right?
Oh, yeah.
Right? Absolutely. Kind of like, hey, what if we care about social welfare?
Yeah.
And maximize social welfare, right? Pareto is just like one definition of efficiency, right. I think.
Oh, very, right.
An
very
optimality limited. That has been very much suited for abuse, right? Yeah. To kind of justify abuse through in the name of efficiency.
No, right. You define efficiency, and then you provide the very specific narrow definition that you define, but exactly. That efficiency might not be necessarily
and
in the interest of others.
What's pathetic about it is that it's a type of efficiency that does not allow you at all to speak about any type of problem with respect to distribution. You cannot talk about distribution using that definition.
And here I have to defend the legacy of the old dead for, 100 years? Well, not quite.
Vilfredo?
Pareto. He coined that concept after developing some of the foundations of what today anybody who studied economics probably saw. We call it the neoclassical school. In that turn of the century, he coined this concept, immediately said, but that's obvious to any kind of preschooler, you know, as a basic principle, and based on this individualistic type of mathematized economics that doesn't look at power, doesn't look at politics, that kind of a new kind of economics that was really weird from people at the time, that's the best we can do in terms of deciding whether one economic policy or another is better. we can only apply this ridiculously simplistic concept I've just articulated here. And obviously nobody in their right mind would be satisfied with it, given that all relevant questions in policy, economics, or any kind of political, social issue involves hurting somebody a little bit for the benefit of the others, or vice versa.
Distribution.
So that criteria that became the the criteria of economics and named after him, Pareto, I mean, he spins in his grave every time, you know, he turns that page in the textbook and learns about Pareto optimality.
Yeah.
Because he coined it as a joke, assuming that nobody would really see that as satisfactory for any kind of real world. And then he quit basically economics and started working on a sociology, basically trying to see, work on the foundations of how people behave, how do people make, what makes people happy, with his mathematical mind.
That was something. He was also like a brilliant mathematician, right? So he was a really strange sociologist, because he was doing all these sociologies like, don't you find that that's kind of like the story with a lot of economic ideas, right? Like, the division of labor was awesome if you're living in Adam Smith's world, right? But you switch it 50 years forward, and the division of labor implies like mass industrialization all over Europe, child employment.
But didn't Adam Smith criticize division of labor too?
Well, yeah, like his theory of the moral sentiments, to some extent, I would argue that would be kind of a very interesting alternative argument that Smith still has in.
He saw the cost, certainly. Yeah. You know, maybe, I mean, even Karl Marx, let's role play. Karl Marx would say that, yeah, but you know, you had to do it. That's one of the things that I like to surprise many students with, right? The fact that you read Adam Smith and he's really like, social justice, the poor, the greedy wealthy. Yeah. I mean, you know, he sounds really red, you know what I mean? And you read Marx and he sounds like some kind of free market ideologue, because he's all, most of his time, capitalism, so necessary, so important to build the basis, to accumulate the capital, build the machines, right, raise in productivity, then it will have to be resolved after into something else. But most of his ink, very prodigious amount of ink, is devoted to praising capitalism, isn't it?
Yeah.
As a necessary stage of development. Because again, he was so non-ethical. In his time, it was all about like pure science. It's like, you know. No ethics, no value judgment. We can somehow be purely rational. It's another era again, you know, but it's very important to notice that, right, you have to take people in their era, you know, otherwise, you know, oh, I won't read any Shakespeare because he was anti-Semitic. That's just silly. Everybody was one way or another, right?
So was Disney, right?
Exactly. Or similar things. You have to take them for what they are, yeah. Oh, right. We have some points of order, and we have to be careful because we might be taken off the air in exactly 31 minutes, right? First of all, I am like playing with my really bad beep. You see, I beep myself. A new phone here. And the only reason I'm able to play with it, an ugly story. I won't get into details, certainly not on the air. It got kind of mutilated before even switched on, and I went to fix it, and something brand new in the history of punkonomics that's been around for now, what, like, I think two and a half years, maybe even, no? Yeah. Yeah, it was some kind of two and a half years or something, or maybe a little over. So for the first time in our history, we actually bumped into somebody in the real world that listens to us, that is not a friend or family member. So
that's not biased, right?
So we're kind of there. The truth is out there, you know.
Well, the girl from the empanadas, you know.
Oh, right. I'm sorry,
empanada
right,
girl,
right.
Empanada girl.
So for me, it was certainly the first time. So I really want to make a shout out to a person who totally saved my life and reconnected me to the Matrix, and giving a little chat we had at the store. He's totally getting that joke. So it's Joshua Dwarning, and he runs the store in the neighborhood, new one that opened in the neighborhood. He's the manager, and he really hooked me up. And I can't do a call for action. I know that, so I'm not going to tell you anything, but I just want to share. that I'm a very, very, very happy customer. And also, I mean, we were chatting and we were discussing some interesting issues that could be relevant, precisely how our institutions are adjusting or perhaps not adjusting to very significant changes happening in the world today into the 21st century, right? And specifically, financial systems. So maybe we want to talk about the potential, or the concept of things like, you know, Bitcoin being the most famous, animal, right? A different kind of currency. Maybe we can put it in the context of the, I mentioned in the show many times, but it really bears, repeating, there is the whole anti-Fed movement, if you will, right? I mean, I'm just giving it a big name, right? There are different ways of saying it. You have libertarians talking about gold standard. You have some much more interesting things. And here, Corey Carroll wrote a paper once back in the day when he was a student that taught me all about the idea of actually linking finance, linking currency, not to gold for some very important reasons. But what he taught me is how maybe energy is a really great idea. It's almost like one of those where you go, duh, how come everybody's not talking about it? Because it has some positive potential implications. And of course, so right now money is highly monopolistic, at least at the national level, central banks, fiat currency. Let's mix all that up in a bucket and see what we get, shall we?
Well, the interesting thing about the gold standard that I want to point out is, actually there is a historical example of that failing. And I don't know if many people know about it, but it's called the Long Depression. And it's basically, after slavery was abolished and you had the Industrial Revolution, right, the South, even though you had the currency linked to gold, the southern regions of the United States were in a pretty severe depression for a very long time. So tying the currencies to these concrete things like gold or energy doesn't resolve the if you will economic problems or flatten them out, because you still have these you still have these terribly long crashes. So I mean, people who say, hey, look, you know, the problem with our currency is the issue of fiat, or the problem with the currency is that if we link it to this concrete, thing that's measurable and empirical, we'll flatten out, these depressions. They aren't paying attention to history. And I think what is needed right now in terms of our institutions is to realize that America is on the decline of empire, right? You have situations where we have a capitalist economy and very few places are making profit anymore. So for example, Twitter is not running on a profit. Doug Henwood actually alluded to the bubble in the tech startup business. So we need to kind of get out of this notion of, if you will, this classical economic systems, and do what every sensible culture and civilization has done in times of serious economic decline, which is set up a gift economy.
Or at least recognize them. They're already, I mean, gift economies go on anyway, kind of always. But yeah, you touched upon a lot of things. I mean, but just to put it a little bit in context here. So just like, you know, America is declining, is part of the cluster beep problem, I keep saying, right? Because it's multiple crises. The imperial model may have served for a while is running out of steam, no doubt. So you have that. You have inevitable long cycles that lead to kind of needing to reinvest in new capital. We're sitting on a lot of old capital that we had before anybody else. So but it's getting really old. So people who actually developed later have a certain advantage in that sense. There's a whole bunch of different pressures. So it's going to be it's a challenge there. Another very important methodological thing that came out of what you just said, Jay, is that there aren't pure solutions, that some solutions might make sense in a certain circumstance and make utter no sense in others. And in economics, very often we attach to different kind of policies an ideological label, right? So, cut taxes to the wealthy. You know, in the 60s, it actually worked. The one time when that stimulated the economy and history was when, indeed, the tax rates were relatively high. The American economy was burning hot, expanding. So under those, the same logic of, we're crippled on our knees now, to do it now is insanity, as indeed it got us into severe trouble in the successive tax cuts for wealthy people over the past decade. So that's an important thing. I mean, no, it's not ideological. It depends on circumstance. You might come up with some kind of rational combination of policies that is acceptable to different sectors. like a financial, I mean, change. Yeah, yeah, I mean, gold wouldn't work at all. And the South was in serious... You know, that's why, understand me well, that's why they fought the war. Their entire model was based on the slavery model. The notion that we're taught in school that this was already on its way out is utterly false. It's been proven in successive studies for over 30 years now. It was viable. It was a criminal horror and abomination. But in terms of the plantation owners, and it was sweet and getting sweeter.
That depression is also kind of strange. I've read a little bit about it. I'm not that knowledgeable on it, but also the North knew that one way in which it could keep the South down for a really long period of time was to destroy their infrastructure.
Sure, right.
The long-term infrastructure.
Right. So yeah. So you had sort of like it was weird because during that time you had a sort of a free trade agreement going on with the North and the South where. The North would extract the capital and
use it to run the mills. Yeah, colonies for
right,
years.
Right. Mm-hmm. And you know, I think the interesting thing about you know Carroll's paper about linking this to energy is, and this is a reason why I bring up the American decline in empire, is that it's somewhat absurd because with our energy situation. Now, right? So, let me put it this way. So when an empire starts out and starts expanding, right, that's when it starts to do, the bulk of its, if you will, projects, right? Mm-hmm. So that's when it has the majority of its magic tricks. When it's on its decline, there's no more magic tricks, right? So there's no more like, you know, solar power. There's no more like technological magic stick that'll solve the energy crisis. Like
not one. It's precisely involving a very broad, systemic, significant changes in many fundamental ways in which we live. Hence, I'm bringing back that word, but the original definition of political revolution from the actually 17th century, from the 1600s, that the idea being that they're beginning to look at the world. It's early, right? Enlightenment, very early Enlightenment, like, you know, and these early rational thinkers are seeing the world as the body politic. The early economists are seeing the world, well, like a body politic, an organism, a living being, yeah? And it has organs, and organs are like, well, institutions, we'll call them today, and they're interconnected, like with veins and nerves and stuff. They actually have, in some sense, a better metaphor for looking at the economy than most mainstream economists have today. There's a whole other topic that is very close to my heart, where we switched metaphors from biology to physics, and the results were catastrophic, and it's part of the problems with neoclassical economics. But back in those days, people like the, you know, the Royal Society in London, all these new, you know, these... interesting guys, were, the concept of revolution was that Imagine a picture of like bits of institutions, they're all interconnected with lines together, and you have this kind of complex network, network there, and it revolves. Hence the word, right? It's revolve, right? You turn it around. I'm moving my hands, of course, on the radio, not very effective, but, right? Imagine you have that piece of paper showing all these different institutions connected to each other, and you just turn the paper on the table, basically 90 degrees or maybe 180 degrees. You reconfigure the entire system like that in one fell swoop. And that's what they managed. Kind of the Brits are very proud of a relatively very big, the ratio of change to bloodshed was remarkably low by historical.
Well,
so they deserve credit for that. The glorious revolution, glorious for not being violent.
It was remarkably slow because, as Kaczynski pointed out, remarkably bloodless. And it's the same thing with the American Revolution too. They were kind of already going in that direction. So, for example, Audrey and Brian Smedley's book on race, they actually touch on this a little bit, right, about how England was sort of the first European country to throw off feudalism, if you will. They kind of started throwing it off early, really early. So by the time that you got around to the revolution, they were on their way there anyway.
Right. Very gradual, generally. The most gradual of all, and never stalled in a sense, or not too gradual. Right. Holland, some historians would see as somebody who they managed to fully develop with medieval technology and social structures, so they kind of ran out of pressure to change more. They just became developed.
Right.
Early on.
What's also, interesting about this, or what I wanted to say about, at least empire being on the decline too, is that, a point is that, capital, not only is our, the institutions that we have to maintain becoming more expensive to maintain, but capital is way more expensive to extract now from the third world because we've completely depleted the place.
Well, I think that there you kind of touched on something interesting, is it possible to actually have a revolution like the one you're describing in the 21st century when you're globalized, right? That's a question that was pondered, I think, the first one was Trotsky, right? And how kind of uneven development actually impacts your ability to develop. By uneven development, I just simply mean countries that have modern sectors and non-modern sectors and highly agricultural, rural, less technological.
The global level.
So what ends up happening a lot of the times nowadays is when countries that have these large rural sectors try to revolt and change and rotate the institutional framework, other countries step in to do a proxy war in it.
Right? No, absolutely, and it has been for a while. So I mean, right. You're the development economist, so right. I mean, they should have like, hey, and you're Jamaican. Oh, I got a perfect story, right? Manly, right, in the 60s was absolutely right, and he was not assassinated, right? He was just pushed aside, basically forced to compromise. But the notion that no, we do not want your international assistance, basically, we do not want your trade, on the contrary, we will use everything we can to support our farmers so that we can feed ourselves.
Urban is exactly the same
slowly,
story.
Right? We have to develop slower. But it becomes very complicated. Both, of course, the other countries that are surrounding countries attempting to do something different, right? Mm-hmm. And as well as internally too, right? That these developing countries like that, typically in a case like this, the wealthy of that developing country actually would suffer from this because then they won't have foreign currency. They won't be able to buy
the wealthy got wealthy through selling exports, right. To other countries because they are stuck in this extractive process, right? So
the thing is, I mean, the pulling it off, in most of it's scary because in most histories, when you have a model, let's say that worked well, cynically or not, like the United States, very well in some senses, or capitalism as a whole, depending on Western Enlightenment, depending how broad you want to look at it. But when it starts running out of steam, running into trouble, it starts eating itself. Because if people are wondering, right, we're running out, like you guys said, we're running out of being able to exploit the third world effectively as we did. So we're beginning to exploit ourselves. I mean, my fellow American middle classers, the pressure is on. That's because we were bought out for so long by on the backs of people, of poor people, of slaves, et cetera. And now they're coming for us.
So what I want to say in terms of the revolution, I don't think that would we should be thinking globally anymore. We should actually be thinking locally. And I had this discussion, and I think I touched on it the last time I was here. We need to, and this is in the context of, doing things like voting as well. I think we need to turn our backs on the, various, parties and actually come together and identify, problems that we can resolve collectively and collectively act upon without waiting on the federal government or without waiting on a particular bureaucracy. And go ahead and start fixing them. So
creating parallel structures. Right. It's, I mean, yeah, it's harkens. I mean, just to, again, to place it in context, right? You're using sound revolution, you know, sound established revolutionary thinking, the kinds that often, sadly, I think revolutionaries didn't forgot at least once they got into power for one reason or another. Some they have better excuses than others, but yeah, creating all these parallel community-based institutions that so you don't need to literally overthrow the government and create that temptation, by the way, of becoming the new one.
But I think that to some extent, actually, I agree to not go to think of a global revolution, right? But I don't think if you are into a revolutionary project, I think it's extremely useful to look at kind of like what revolutions have happened within, outside of like big developed countries. Because my dissertation topic is about informal economies, you know, and I have heard people call that a form of revolution, right? Mm-hmm. Where you completely exit the system because the system was never designed for you to work in, you know? Mm-hmm. And this has been going on in Latin America for quite a while. So it's kind of like an interesting example of what you're calling kind of collective action, right? In the sense that, hey, that system of rules that was supposed to be constitutional and designed for everybody, hey, surprise, surprise, it wasn't. It was designed for a very small minority with a lot of political and economic power, right? So I think it's kind of like needs to look at those examples.
So good things come together. Bitcoin is also revolutionary. Bitcoin might better often be a historical concept. There's a pretty good chance of it, right? Yeah, when are we on? The sporting, what's that? The Spintron thing, you know, our website, WPRK website.
Yeah, I just put it in
working
there.
Working out nicely. Excellent. You know, slowly but surely. You know, I'm thinking, okay, so people move out, right? Working in parallel structures, right? Yeah. Taking care of themselves in a sense, given that the governmental structures are not representing them effectively.
Nor the formal ones.
But not the formal ones.
Not the formal economic ones. Because it's not just the government, right? It's also the private sector who excludes them, right?
Because it's formal and tied in. But could you have, and revolutions take time, so maybe it's not Bitcoin, but at some point, I'm going back to the question a little bit. I'm going to make a metax show. Joshua Dwarning's question. So if we do move, a new platform will emerge, right? But the idea that it's decentralized, there is no central bank, right? It has some stability kind of built into the structure, but it's not really owned by anybody. It doesn't have a guarantor. It's like all the users are guaranteeing it kind of together. It could be encrypted. In fact, it could be more encrypted than Bitcoin, right? So that would stop the ability to follow off the flow of capital and, which is, can be a good thing and a bad thing, by the way.
I think that
alternative currency, could that serve the informal sector? Could we have these?
It's already doing it.
Right. I'm thinking, you know, different community parallels.
The shadow virtual economy is already basically transacted in.
Well, I think to some extent that, you know, while I don't mind Bitcoin, I think it's a part of the formal, economy, right? So I think that, with various tech companies, people look at them a little bit differently, like, than other corporations. So they look at Google and Amazon as, you know, very hip, very, very cool, and not, you know, like your regular Walmart, if you will. And
like the Google corporate slogan, right? Right.
I think in the case of Bitcoin, you know, for me at least, a little bit of skepticism is necessary. But in terms of, you know, something like the revolution that I was talking about, and acting collectively to solve problems and issues. So, for example, we could do things like retrofit houses to keep the lights on. Yeah, we might not have a renewable energy source to replace cheap oil and keep things running all the time. But if we can do things like get houses off the grid or something like that, so that someone can listen to a radio. Or,
but it's hard to start off, without outfit, steam, right?
Yeah.
It's really hard to start off. I mean, it harkens back. I mean, that we have solutions. I mean, we could, right? If I was declared, a dictator of the world, I'm solving a lot of the problems, with little pain and suffering. Of course, dictators are problematic because, right? Even if you have a really good one, then there's sooner or later going to be inherited by a really bad one. One of the main problems there. But yeah, we could do all those things better, but we don't kind of have the structures that lead us. So you're saying go off the political grid, certainly, and do it for yourself. But it's a big challenge, given that
you're exiting, right, the political group, right, the powerful group, might find that as an excuse to behave in a more abusive way, right? So, which has happened. Very, very.
No, in poor countries, there are a lot of people do work outside because
that's, and I mean that's true. But that's something. I think that's a bridge that we have to come to when we cross it. But in terms of having the mechanisms to just turn away and do that, you're absolutely right. We don't. So we don't have, say in terms of discussing things with people. Most people, and including educated people, are really incapable of having rational discussion. And by that I mean in terms of a discussion that interprets a side that they don't like charitably, if you will, or responding to a side that they disagree with in a reasonable fashion, addressing whatever it is they're talking about. Most people can't at all do that.
Habermas's Sprache, right? My people, the rhetoric of economics tribe, right. All like eight of us.
So I mean, a lot of people don't even have the right. Don't even have that skill to do that, because, if you will, they're in a very vegetative state. And
well, it's hard to see outside of the context. In fact, it's one of the things that postmodernism is supposed to should have taught us by now. But it's a very tricky business to kind of really to get out of your own shoes, right? It's hard enough to get into other people's shoes, but it's even harder to get out of anything, any shoes. There's no way of looking objectively at things. So it's always been a bit of a challenge, and it's times of change. So often we go back. Some would say, let's try and get back to the America that functioned very well. I mean, I think, for example, here, Robert Reich, right? A really nice guy. You got to give him credit for a lot of things. And he's always about this kind of, let's go back to the 70s, right? That's when American capitalism worked. Well, it sure worked better than it does now. But I don't think it's an option, actually. I think that's a false hope.
And I think a lot of economists have pointed that out very clearly, right? Like, the problem of adopting Robert Reich's position is the fact that, like, if you find how to deal with a market that has been already captured, right, and with a government that has already been captured by the private sector, big corporations, big monopolies, call it whatever, that's like the holy grail of political science and economics right now, I think. Yeah. Like, nobody knows what, once it's captured, once it's regulated, because if government was the one supposed to basically keep the sizes of corporations small, and keep competition fair, and keep them, if government was, and these guys are in the
in
exact
essence,
same
keep
boat,
the market free, though, funnily enough,
that's
this
a
is
funny
aspect, not a call that
right?
Most,
like, if government was the one who was going to keep the market free, what do you do when those who are not interested in keeping a free market have already regulated?
Right. That's the core job, right? It's too late now.
It's too late. Yeah, like the big question is, and I ask this actually kind of like for my generation, you know, like at what point will we do something about it? You know, in like 10 years from now, 20 years from now. So let's keep them growing and let's keep them spilling oil.
And we don't have a ready model. So that speaks to the challenge. So like Jay was saying, you know, that, okay, looking at these kind of community based, parallel organizations, which is definitely, I agree, certainly at the very least, a very important part of the solution at the very least. And not really know how it's going to unfold itself because we can't say, oh, I have the recipe. It's some kind of, you know, Randian, naive free market utopia, or no, I have the recipe at some kind of, you know, socialist, you know, state capitalism, Soviet Union style, or none of these recipes are relevant, let alone attractive.
I mean, I like.
We don't know what the solution
recipe,
is.
Actually.
It's a process.
One of my favorite economists, Eleanor Ostrom, is my favorite economist because she is the first female to actually win the Nobel Prize in economics, right? Like very recently, people in a 200-year-old discipline.
It's a fake Nobel Prize anyway, right? So that's another story.
Pathetic about the gender equality in the field.
It's too bad that people don't read her, though. Adam Smith.
You know exactly, who read her, by the way, know? Just to, out of the blue here? You know, the people who read her are kind of, she's much better read on the right. When I say right, I'm talking about those, you know, those good Austrians. You know, my students are rolling their eyes already, you know, like the good Austrians.
But you know, I think
they're a small minority of the Austrians.
Tiny minority that may perhaps save themselves from complete absurdity. But I think that one of the aspects that she touches on, and it's also an aspect that I can actually talk about the Austrians, you know, and Hayek also made the same point, that is that collective action has a scale problem. That I think that one of the aspects
hard to
that
organize,
you touched
large
on
scale.
Was, we start small scale, right? And the problem is, and we don't think globally, what happens when the problem is global? Say climate change, or say internet, or say I don't know what happens. How do you deal with those problems where power can still be coercive, but you have to think big?
So in terms of the climate change thing, I don't think that there will be a silver bullet at this point. What we have to do now is
exercise the politicians,
but implement a soft landing. So that's some of the things that I'm talking about.
Managing the catastrophe,
right? So it's managing the catastrophe. Right. So for example, instead of using or splurging energy resources to engage in one last orgy of mass production, maybe we can start using our energy resources a little bit smarter, right? Retrofitting homes to, you know, keep a light on or to give someone hot water.
We just ran out of time.
We have Roland's women's basketball team playing somewhere. I'm not sure where.
Who knows? Yeah. Anyway, we'll be back next week, hopefully.
I hope they beat whoever it is there.
Yep. And remember, all opinions stated here today are solely ours, not of Roland's College. Or anybody else for that matter, right?
No, not necessarily.
Anyway, have a great day, and
we'll keep it up. We'll just pick it up.
Stay safe.
Next week.
Hey, this is Mr. Patnick.